I'm Michael Geary, and this is the EU History Podcast. On this episode, we start on a rather somber subject, namely one of the biggest mining disasters in post-war Western European history that occurred in Belgium in 1956 when 262 miners were killed. Did this disaster sow the seeds for a European risk society? And did it serve to create safer work and health conditions in the mining industry by utilizing the institutional mechanisms of the then newly created European Coal and Steel Community? To answer these and other questions and to shed light on the emergence of a European risk society, I'm delighted to be joined today by Siegfried Evans, a historian specialized in the history of risk and disaster, who is currently finishing his PhD at KTH Royal Institute of Technology in Stockholm, Sweden. Siegfried, welcome to the EU History Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
By way of starting off, can you provide a little bit of context in terms of this particular mining disaster in Belgium and I suppose where it fits into the wider historiography of big European disasters like this? How have historians contextualized this particular disaster?
Yeah, so first of all, you mentioned that indeed the disaster was in 1956. It was on the 8th of August, 1956, and a mine in the southern part of Belgium, in Wallonia, close to Charleroi, in a town called Marcinelle, in the Bois de Cazier mine. And it was a terrible disaster. It's still, in terms of casualties, the biggest post-war disaster in Belgian history. 262 miners died. But it's not really a very traditional disaster that is often a sort of national drama, because most of the casualties in that disaster were not Belgian. So there were 95 Belgian miners who died, but there were 136 Italian miners that died in the accident. So that's almost half of the casualties. And so it was a huge shock in Belgium, but it was arguably even bigger in Italy, especially because a lot of these Italian mine workers came there because, you know, to flee poverty from poorer regions, especially in the south of Italy. They were immigrants. They lived in poor conditions. We'll talk about that a bit later. And so you can really say that this is a disaster that's part of the collective memory in Belgium, but even more so in Italy. And you see that even today, like just last August for the commemoration, Giorgia Meloni, the current prime minister, releases a statement, and either the prime minister or the president in Italy does that every year without any exception. But then apart from that, in other countries, it's an accident or disaster that's not very well known. But in Belgium, and especially in Italy, this is very, very big. And in terms of historiography, I wouldn't say that this is a much researched disaster, but it is researched in some quite niche historiographies. And one of them is really a historiography that is more situated in the social justice, environmental justice part, that really, from a Marxist perspective, engages with questions of blame, right? Who was responsible for this? And uses that Marxist perspective to show the exploitation of the mine workers and how class justice was involved as well. And then you have a bit of another literature that really focuses on the European integration. And there you have a few authors, and it's often part of these sort of bigger collections and histories of European integration, where Marcinelle sort of pops up as one of these moments or earliest moments that you start to have social policy as a discussion. And of course, social policy, we know that, I mean, today that's really a part of the European Union, but at the time, of course, it absolutely wasn't. Wages, working conditions, regulating migration, and so on. And that's often really also portrayed as a history of failure, that the accident did not really manage to address those issues and further integration. And we will also probably talk about that further. But what I kind of observed was that in historiography, despite the fact that this is really a big disaster and it involves so many complex risks and mining risks and thinking about these coal mines as complex technological systems, that there wasn't really an analysis of risk and risk management and risk regulation before and after the accident that at Bois de Cazier. So what I wanted to do in the article is think about how technology and society interact, how they're not sort of decoupled, but how they're connected, And analyze the accident more from a risk perspective, and maybe not focusing exactly on the direct impact of that accident specifically, but what has Marcinelle meant in sort of the larger evolution of the European Union or the European communities working, interacting with risk and regulating risk and managing that in a society, you know, the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s with rapid technological development? How does that accident fit in that wider sort of evolution?
Of course, with many of these disasters, there emerges this rather quickly, I suppose, this idea of the blame game, right? Who's responsible? And how does this play out with Marcinelle?
I mean, it was a very ferocious blame game, I would argue. I mean, I've studied a few disasters, but this one was very polarizing and conflicting, and of course, for very understandable reasons. So I would say that, I mean, there's kind of two sides in this story. On the one side, you have industry, and also to an extent, the Belgian government, the coal industry, big coal companies. And very quickly after the accident, blame is put on that individual miner that made a mistake. Because I should have maybe mentioned this in the introduction, but this accident was caused by a mine chariot that got stuck in an elevator. So the elevator went up and the mine chariot wasn't exactly in the elevator yet. So the chariot hit all kinds of cables and the pipes and whatnot. And so there was gas being released and there was a big fire that in that way killed those miners. So that one miner that controlled the elevator and the chariot was blamed for this. By the mine itself, by the mine director and the company. But of course, on the other side, you have the unions and Socialist Party and sort of the whole workers' movement at the time, and also of course in Italy, parts of Italian government and so on, and Italian opinions that say no, this is a structural cause. Like, these workers are being exploited, they're working on unsafe conditions, and this is fault of the Belgian government and of the mining companies. And of course, you don't have to be Karl Marx to see that they had a point. I mean, the working conditions were really troubling. They were really bad. They lived in very poor conditions. And I mean, there are estimates that in Belgium, by that time, around 24,000 miners had already died in Belgian coal mines. So these are enormous numbers, and Belgian mines were renowned or notorious for being unsafe and dangerous. And that, of course, had to do with the fact that coal was very important for the energy system in Belgium, and you had to produce a lot of coal very cheaply. So that's why. And you have a lot of lawsuits after the accident, and then there's one lawsuit where the mine director gets indicted for structural deficiencies. And this, of course, causes a lot of strikes, because this still does not really address the sort of more structural issues that these unions and socialists and also Christian democratic unions really see. So yes, it's really a ferocious blame game, and it goes on for years and years after the accidents, both in newspapers and in public debate, but also in the courtrooms.
And I suppose, like, from your research, what I find fascinating is rather quickly you see emerging calls for a quote-unquote European response, and perhaps unsurprisingly, these calls are coming from the left, as you mentioned, you know, the workers, the unions and the workers' movements. But I suppose what I found really fascinating and perhaps a bit confusing, troubling to me, was what did the unions or what did the labor movement expect this newly emerging European coal and steel community to do? That was one question. And then the other follow-up was, at the time, what powers did the European coal and steel community have to respond to a disaster like Marcinelle?
I mean, this is really the unique point of this disaster, I think, where it really differentiates with other accidents, is that these unions, but also many other public actors, look at the European community of steel and coal for action. And I think this is really unique because, I mean, there's multiple reasons. So basically, who looks at the European community for steel and coal at that moment is the unions, both socialist and Christian Democrats, is the Italian government. And even in Belgium, the European community of steel and coal is involved in the judicial investigations. So they all look Like no matter what side they were on, they all look at this new international organization at the time for action. And this is really unique because, as I said, it's a very young organization. It only exists a couple of years. It's very unknown at the time. It's sort of seen as this very bureaucratic, weird economic organization that is not at all involved with the safety of workers or anything like that. It's very atypical because usually after disasters in a sort of national context, people look at national agencies or national governments to come up with solution. And of course, there's some criticism of the Belgian government, but you very quickly see that the focus shifts to the European level. And then as you addressed in your question, people were not even sure if this new international organization was competent, if the treaty even allowed them to make legislation or rules or some kind of harmonization for safety in the mines. So the treaty did mention something about working conditions. And before the accident, it had started some programs on silicosis, which is this lung disease that miners have or get after a while. But it was clear that it had very limited instruments, and it was not a core activity of this organization. And I mean, at least to my knowledge, it happens very seldom that an international organization is targeted so quickly, especially in this period when you don't have a lot of European integration on that level yet, that they suddenly target sort of the European institutions so quickly for action. And that has, of course, to do with what I said earlier, is this is a transnational disaster in many ways. It's a very atypical disaster. Half of the casualties are not from the country where the accident happened. You have pressures from the Italian government. You have similar coal mines in other places where also foreign workers work, right? These workers just move across borders all the time. And so, you know, if you're an Italian minister or an Italian, you see your workers go to different countries, you want them to be safe. So this is really, it becomes a very transnational issue very quickly. And of course, it's also about coal. There's just this one international organization that has only, you know, two very core activities, coal and steel. So that's also one of the reasons why people look at it immediately. But as I'd like to stress, this was quite unique, actually.
And of course, what accentuates this is that there are two members of the ECSC who were central to the story, which is the Italians and the Belgians. And then, you know, the ECSC kind of moves center stage, at least for the Italians, to try to see whether this organization that Italy has joined can do something to deal with this. And in terms of, I suppose, in the context of responding to this, then you have the emergence of an intergovernmental conference. What is this conference designed to do? And I suppose a broader question, how important is this, I suppose, in advancing the integration process within the context of the disaster itself, within the context of risk?
Yeah, so this conference took place on the 4th of February, 1952. So this is, 1957, which is 1 year later. And I would argue it tries to do two things. First of all, it tries to gather expertise on the issue, just, you know, from different experts. It's really an expert conference. I don't think it's that much of a political conference, really. It just gathers experts from different mining companies and industries and inspection agencies and so on. But there's also, I think, a political motive behind this conference, and that is that the ECSC and especially the high authority of the European Community of Steel and Coal wants to find legitimacy for some reason, organizes this conference to show, look, we're gathering the expertise, we're trying to do something about it. We don't really know what we're going to do yet, and we don't really know what we are allowed to do, but we're going to find out, and we're going to do this at this conference. And they want to sort of play this coordinating role, bringing everyone together. And in this way, I think, really try to kickstart the integration process in this area. And I think, interestingly, you see that the conference very quickly divides up when organizing it. It really divides up quickly between technical aspects and what they call human factors. Right. And technical risks, you know, that would be, you know, the gas and the fire safety and that kind of stuff. Like, it's very sort of decoupled from human operators and miners. And then you have on the human factor side, that's sort of the social policy side. They're going to talk about wages and integration of migrant workers into the workforce and the language issues that they have and work time and wages and so on. And you see that this is a very controversial topic, this human factors topic. So there's even a big discussion on whether it should be discussed at the conference at all. And the unions really have to fight very hard to have this on the agenda of the conference. Initially, the mining companies and industrial organizations, they don't want it on the agenda. They don't think it's a competence of the European institutions to do this. And these technical factors, I think they're actually quite interesting. I mean, they're about ventilation, electrification, as I said, fire safety, gas, which is a super big issue in coal mining safety, that is fine being discussed, dust, collapses, transport, because as I said, these accidents happened all the time in coal mines all over Europe. And it is also here that Italy comes in and says, we want an independent watchdog on this. We want someone who regulates this, and we don't want it to be connected to mining companies or the coal industry and the steel industry, which was often connected to the high authority. There were criticisms that the European community of steel and coal was too close with these industrial interests. So I think this conference is it's an important event because what you see is that you have this national accident, but it causes again this sort of international mobilization and experts from all over Europe and even outside of the community member states at the time, like even experts from the UK played a big role also gathering. And very interestingly, Michael, it's interesting that in that conference, Marcinelle is actually rarely mentioned. So I looked at the report of the conference, and Bois de Cazier or Marcinelle was not even mentioned. So this is a discussion that is, in a way, much larger. Suddenly, the discussion is opened up, and there's more talk about more general, like industrial risk in these European countries. How are we going to manage that? Which knowledge and which regulations are we going to mobilize to do this? So very quickly, this becomes a very broad impetus for European integration in risk more generally. But there's one country that really does not like to see this happening, and that's France. And that's not at all a unique stance. Like at this time, France was sort of trying to block a lot of European integration efforts. But you see that the conference sort of, is really being, like they really put the brake on things. But there's other countries that really welcome this conference, and that even when you look at the sources and later sort of laws that are being passed in those countries, there's a correlation between ideas at the conference and measures that are being taken by national governments. So countries that are very receptive to this, like Italy, like Belgium also, the Netherlands as well, despite the fact that the Netherlands did not have a lot of coal mines. Mm. So there's really a difference also in how different member states perceive this conference, and that impacts the success of it.
And one of the tangible outcomes is this mining safety commission, which I was fascinated about. And how far, I mean, what was it designed to do? But moreover, like, how far does it address like wider mining safety issues after Marcinelle? I mean, is this a kind of a game-changing organization or commission, addresses health and safety? You know, does it significantly advance the rights of miners more generally after 1956?
I think that's debatable. I'm afraid it didn't very much. The Mine Safety Commission, I think, really had the intention of being this strong political body, like a regulatory agency that would pressure industry and the high authority and the European community at large into taking mining risks very seriously and passing new legislation and so on. I think in practice, it became more a center of expertise, where experts gathered, where information was passed on and coordinated. And I think exactly because some member states were really not on board with such a supranational body governing over industrial risks, it became more of this center of expertise or expertise hub that focused on research. So what this commission did is instigate a lot of research projects and fund projects on cables and electricity and liquids in mines, engines, fire safety again, ventilation and so on. You also see that they work a bit with healthcare in the mines and get involved with the medical inspection of miners in these mines. One, I think where this commission made sort of the biggest concrete, tangible impact is gas masks. So this is something that that miners are much better equipped with in the aftermath of Marcinelle, and these oxygen masks to sort of keep the gas out. That was really a consequence of sort of the research and funding efforts of this commission. But in a lot of ways, it did not meet the expectations that it originally had from the conference and from the debates after the Marcinelle accident. So it did not address any of the social questions that were labeled human factors. It did not address wages, hours, migration issues, integration of foreign workers. It did nothing on emergency preparedness. So that was also a plan that this commission would sort of coordinate. If a mining accident would happen, for instance, in Belgium, that neighboring countries could send help very quickly and rescue efforts could be organized more efficiently. Nothing happened. Nothing of those plans sort of materialized. And then there's also an interesting aspect that the Mine Safety Commission did not influence the number of deaths or casualties in any way. What you see is that the injuries from mining accidents in the European, in these countries that are part of the European Community of Steel and Coal actually go up. The number of deaths go down, but that is also mainly because at this time, some coal miners are just closing or are using less manual labor force. And so what you see is that the number of deaths is decreasing, but the number of injuries because of often usage with machines and so on is increasing. But the Mine Safety Commission cannot really impact that. We don't really see sort of a correlation on that. And because of that, the Common Assembly, which is sort of the predecessor of the European Parliament today, is very harsh for this commission. I mean, they're basically tasked with sort of supervising this commission, but they're like, what are you doing? Like, we don't see any results. They publish report after report complaining about the operations. That's, of course, great source material because of those reports, I got an idea of how this commission works and what they did and what they didn't do. And I think no one disputed the usefulness of this commission. It was just that some member states, and mostly France, did not want this commission to go any further than what it did. And sort of, I think one member of the Common Assembly even said, like, we should make a new Mine Safety Commission, a Mine Safety Commission 2.0, to replace the old one, because this is useless. So I think, to go back to your question, Michael, I think for miners, this is really a mixed bag. I mean, there are some results, but whether we really needed a sort of big European new agency for that, or whether this really had a sort of life-changing impact in their day-to-day work, I don't think so. And I think that was also the frustration of many at the time.
Yeah, and the article you wrote is fascinating, largely because it, I suppose, shows the disconnect between the really great political success of the European coal and steel community and kind of squaring the circle of Franco-German relations. But then when you kind of drill down to the street level, all of these areas like safety within coal and steel are largely still in the hands of member state competences. There's a lot of these things that are just not the unfinished business of the early years of integration, and then progressively things change. But you know what struck me reading your work was a lot of European common policies like the cap, fisheries, had all of these problems as well at the start, right? Where they didn't really think, for example, with cap or fisheries, the environmental impact in the 70s or environmental considerations when they designed it. All of those things kind of came later, but a lot of damage had been done. And I really thought when I read your work, you know, there was echoes of later elements of the integration process in other policy areas that are, you know, that just are carbon copies of, you know, they do great in these big, big strides forward, but then there's an awful lot that are simply not included or for various reasons, right? They either, it wasn't topical at the time, or perhaps in this case, reluctance by member states to hand over too much of national competence in areas like on the social factors, the human factors, social policy. This is obviously, you know, a big crisis. It's a huge mining disaster. Like, how far is this, is the Marcinelle disaster an early example of kind of crisis-driven policy learning or crisis-driven European integration? Or do you see it in that context?
I mean, to go back first to your comment, I think I agree 100% with you that this is sort of a fond la lettre story, and that you see a lot of aspects and the issues and the problems of European integration that we even see up until today, sort of already foreshadowed here. I mean, I currently work on nuclear safety and which of course later you have Euratom also, you see the same dynamics also there. To come to your question about European integration, I think it's really a mixed bag. So as I said, in sort of tangible results, they are quite limited, and sort of none of these really social integration that so many people wanted at the time, union officials, but also just European bureaucrats wanted, did not materialize. But what I try to argue in the article, and I think this is really important, is that it's also not true that nothing happened. I mean, this accident really played a role, but more in the wider scope of things, in how this new European institution is going to manage and regulate risk in general. Because what you see is that despite the fact that this Mine Safety Commission has struggles, you see that its activities and its concerns is going to spill over very soon. And as you might know, Michael, spillover is this, of course, in European integration, this very important thing that, you know, and that's also why the European Community of Steel and Coal started so small but could expanded. I mean, if you integrate well in one area, it might spill over to other areas. And I would argue that this was the same for this Mine Safety Commission, is that suddenly it starts expanding to other areas. So what you see is that in 1964, the commission also becomes competent for steel, safety in steel mills. 1965, extra activities on health and hygiene. 1974, you get a body for all extractive industries in these member states. Afterwards, you see that these activities continue in the European communities and in the European Union up until today. There's still today this agency called ECOSOC, so that's like the Economic and Social Committee, and that's sort of where the Mine Safety Commission transitioned into, and those networks stayed, and those activities stayed. So we also really have to see this in a sort of long-term perspective. This Mine Safety Commission did not suddenly cease to exist. It transitioned further into that bureaucratic apparatus. The engagement with the European institutions and risk just continued. It became so much bigger at the end of the 70s, but I would argue especially in the 80s, with the Single European Act in 1984, you get safety standards for the workplace. And then I already touched upon it, nuclear safety already at the end of the 60s, Euratom is trying to find its place, trying to also further integration in the nuclear field. And the Mine Safety Commission, and I should maybe contextualize this a bit more. So I wrote this article sort of in between my master thesis on fire safety and my current PhD thesis on nuclear safety. And sort of in the first year of my PhD, I was trying to finish this article. But I was also going through sources for my PhD, and I found discussions in Euratom referring to this Mine Safety Commission, saying this is what we need for the nuclear sector as well. This is a commission, a regulatory agency that regulates safety in European nuclear power plants, just as it was intended with the Mine Safety Commission in European coal mines. And sort of you see that this Mine Safety Commission starts to spill over and inspire other branches of these European institutions. So I think in many ways, Marcinelle was not unique in, I don't know, the sort of crisis-driven policy that it created or that it spurred, but I think it was unique in the fact that, you know, sort of in an EU perspective, I think it really kickstarted the European institutions' engagement with risk. It sort of put risk management on a wider agenda. And I don't think it ever really left, because if you look at the European Union today, it is so preoccupied with risk. This European Risk Society that you mentioned in the beginning is really very much there and is very active. Like, I mean, during COVID, right, the vaccines, terrorism, maybe you might know this, but like the European Union even regulates sort of the signals from train tracks, right? The sort of safety systems that trains don't crash in each other. When in Greece, there was this train derailment that killed a lot of students. It was actually a European sort of system that is prescribed by the European Union that was not installed. Nuclear is exactly the same. But I think Marcinelle was just very early in this. It was really the event that I think kickstarted all of this. And that's also where the title of the article comes from, The Seeds of European Risk Society. It wasn't that anything blossomed after the Marcinelle accident in terms of big growth in European integration or anything like that, but the seeds were planted. And I think that's very, very important. And you see that, you know, there's a lot of literature today on exactly that, you know, the European Union's engagement with risk and crisis and disaster. And what I wanted to do and what I wanted to do with this argument about the seeds of the European Risk Society is to historicize this a bit, right? Where does this come from? Where does this engagement with risk come from?
And indeed, it is a very impressive article for written by somebody who's just starting his doctorate a couple of years ago and published in the European Review of History. And now you are coming to the end of your doctorate. You are close to the finish line. The defense date is already set. And you mentioned it's on nuclear safety. Can you, I know PhD students love talking about their research, but we have limited time. So maybe you can just summarize what your doctoral thesis has been all about.
Especially at the end of one's PhD, one wants to
talk
about it even more. No, it's about nuclear safety, and it's about the regulation of risks related to water and steam in nuclear power plants. So nuclear power plants use a lot of water, use steam technologies to keep everything going. But that also means that these steam technologies are important for preventing nuclear accidents. And my PhD is a sort of long-term history of regulation, looking at how these technologies were regulated. And the main argument is actually that, you know, the regulations of these water and steam technologies in nuclear power plants today, they go back all the way to the 19th century when we were preventing steam locomotive explosions or boiler explosions in your factory with steam engines around the corner. And these regulations, that's sort of the more complex process I entangle in, disentangle in my thesis, is how these old steam regulations were turned into more nuclearized regulations and the debates that were involved with that. Sort of very contentious issue. What is nuclear and what is steam in this reactor? Where are we going to set the boundary between that? So that's a bit what the thesis is about.
I ask each of my podcast guests a random question from the Proust questionnaire. And Siegfried, here is yours. Which living person do you most despise?
I mean, this is a tough question, but I think maybe since we're now on the topic of like technology and risk and society and how to regulate risk, I think maybe someone like Elon Musk is someone who is really on the wrong track, I think, for so many ways. And I mean, I don't think I have anything personal against him, but I just despise him for, I don't know, what he did to Twitter, which was this amazing social medium before he took over. And also the blind techno-optimism, expecting that, you know, you can change the world just by technology or exploring Mars and sort of, I don't know, inventing a new electric car, but then you really see that the car also fails on so many levels in the production and accidents. I mean, it remains to be seen whether how safe it is. I think it's just, he just personifies for me technological hubris and like overestimating oneself and underestimating what technology can do to society and the limits of technology. He has no idea about that. And that's why I don't think I like him very much, Michael.
Yes, I suspect many might select Elon Musk as the person living person that they most despise. Yeah. Siegfried Evans, a historian specialized in the history of risk and disaster, who is currently a PhD researcher at KTH, Royal Institute of Technology in Stockholm, Sweden. Thanks for being my guest on this episode of the EU History Podcast. I'm Michael Geary. Thanks for listening.